Today is March 29th, 2013, and I call Senate Resources Committee to order. The time is 3:32 p.m. Members present, Vice Chair Dyson, Senator Fairclough, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused are Senators Bishop, French, and McGuire. So welcome. We have three bills on the agenda today. Under bills previously heard, we're returning to Senate Bill 71, payment of fishery resource landing tax. We have completed public testimony on that. Are there any concluding comments from members or the bill sponsor? Seeing none. Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Yeah, I think we did not amend it. Is that correct?
You are correct. I think you have a motion there as well.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 71, Version A, from committee with added fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing none, the bill moves from this committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the transmittal documents. Record? We'll sign those documents later. All right. Next on the agenda is Senate Resolution 5, Chinook bycatch limits. It is before us, and Senator Machicki, would you like to present your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move we adopt committee substitute for SR 5 version C, dated 3/22/13. But before adoption, I'd like to make one change on page 3, line 21, to delete the word require and insert the word encourage.
All right. Is there objection? Hearing none, this CS is adopted. Would you like to present the bill, Senator Machicki?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, you know, our recreational subsistence and commercial fisheries have faced dramatic shortfalls of Chinook salmon in recent years. It's caused a lot of hardships for Alaska residents. The economic losses due to a low abundance of Chinook salmon in 2012 alone in sport and commercial fisheries in Alaska were over $34 million. Not including the significant effects on subsistence and personal use resource users. You know, an example, in your district and mine, and last summer I was the mayor of a sport fishing town, Soldotna. I'm also a commercial fisherman in Cook Inlet, but it began as a very promising year throughout the state and ended in an economic disaster, many not knowing how they would get through the winter. They pulled a symposium together last year, and they're working on a lot of the gaps on understanding how to maintain sustainable stocks of Chinook salmon throughout the state. But one of the problems facing us is salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska trawl fisheries. According to a 2013 report by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the five-year average total for Chinook salmon bycatch in these fisheries was 40,621 fish. I'm not blaming the failure of our Chinook salmon fisheries on the trawlers. I want that perfectly clear. But those fish, if they'd not been intercepted, would have returned to Alaska waters and provided harvest opportunities as well as the escapement we need. This resolution simply asks the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to take action to reduce the level of Chinook bycatch in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska trawl fisheries to at least half of the current limits. In this time of low king salmon abundance, it's critical that unintended mortality be reduced. And this resolution is an attempt to address a known cause of substantial mortality and help restore strong king salmon runs in our rivers. In a state where folks seem to really enjoy fighting over fish, support of this resolution represents one of the rare instances of an issue where all fishing Alaskans are united. In your packets, you'll see support from commercial sport and subsistence users from around the state, including the Association of Village Council Presidents, the Tananoosh Chiefs Conference, the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly, Cooper Landing Advisory Committee, Alaska Marine Conservation Council, the Kenaitse Indian Tribe, and I have a list of individuals that have also commented favorably. Madam Chair, this resolution is not about blame, since I don't believe any type of gear type of commercial fishing, sport fishing, or subsistence fishing is responsible for the low abundance of Chinook fisheries. I honestly believe the trawl fisheries have worked very hard to reduce Chinook bycatch. This resolution is simply about returning as many Chinook to our river systems to spawn as possible to hopefully allow our natural cycles to return to our river systems and return them to systems of abundance. Every fish matters. While our constituents suffer from sport, commercial, and subsistence closures, and our lodges suffer from cancellations, we're simply asking for the trawl fisheries and individual trawl fishing boats to do better, the best they can. For example, the highest boat so far this year is reported catching 980 Chinook salmon, which is 8 times more king salmon than all of the fish caught by sport fishermen on the Kenai River system last summer. And there are 3 quarters left to go in the year. This resolution is about spreading the effort. Madam Chair, you and I faced 450 of the commercial fishing families in our 2 districts on the Kenai that were out of work last summer. While sport fishing, subsistence, and commercial fishermen were severely restricted throughout the state, the trawl fisheries were fishing as usual without absorbing much of the economic challenge of the other fisheries and fishermen. This resolution simply asks more fisheries to share the burden of the road to recovery for Alaska's coastal runs of Chinook salmon.
Thank you, Senator. So at this time, are there any questions from committee members for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, let's open public testimony. I've got the call-in sheets from folks online, so we'll start there while we're getting the other sign-in sheet. There's Bethel and Anchorage. I'm going to start in Bethel with Angie Whitman. Angie, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. Angie, if you would introduce yourself and tell us your name and your affiliation, I'm going to allow 2 minutes each for folks in public testimony. So if you would do that and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Angie Whitman. I live and work in Bethel. I am a constituent of Senator Hoffman, Senate District S. I am representing myself.
Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I am speaking in support of Senate District Resolution 5, and I'd like to bring my viewpoint on this resolution. The issue I bring up is one of injustice. One group is legally allowed to waste our salmon resource while we on the Kuskokwim were severely restricted, issued citations, made to appear in court, and paid fines. It's great to have this resolution, and thank you, Senator McKitchy, for the because we need that reduction of salmon bycatch. It's too bad that other areas of the state were affected by the incredible bycatch numbers. We have had to fight for reduction of interception of our salmon resources way back in 2004 regarding Area M, and here just a few years later for the high seas trawl fisheries waste termed bycatch. It's too bad that we have to place so much attention on this problem because we have so many other problems which need our time and attention, such as fuel prices that go through our roofs, literally, for fuel and electricity. I want to word my statement in such a way as to be resonating in your memories that maybe you won't sleep at night until this problem of injustice is corrected. We are trying to assure that we have our dried fish and other sustenance which Chinook salmon provide for us. You cannot put a dollar value on it because Walmart, AC, and Costco do not sell the bounty that Chinook provides for us. And no fishery disaster declaration can replace or does because those declarations only try to replace business-associated loss. There is no business loss to me or for many hundreds of people who went without Chinook last summer. I felt it, and so did many others. Are we able to make a claim for loss? No. While there is a waste of our salmon resource occurring on the high seas, we are told to conserve. Do not go out fishing. There are low numbers of returning Chinook salmon. We, the people of the region, must have our resources returned to us. To those who vote in the legislature, please vote to pass Senate Resolution 5. It's a resolution worthy which would benefit residents of this state, the people of the Kuskokwim region find they are a member of. Sometimes I wonder why we are a member of this state when it seems the legislature doesn't seem to notice the high prices of fuel, groceries, airfare, and life loss due to alcohol and drug abuse and the lack of relevant historic education in the schools. But we are here, far away in the roadless land which we love. Please put an end to the waste of our precious salmon resource. This resolution is a start. Thank you for your time, your hard work to represent the people of the state. Godspeed to you and the legislature to help bring justice to the people of our region. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Angie. If you would like to send your testimony in written form, we can attach it to this resolution as it goes through the process. Are there any questions for Angie? Seeing none, we'll go next to the Anchorage LIO, where a gentleman from Homer is online, Pete Whedon. Are you there, Pete?
I am. Can you read me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear. Your name, affiliation, and then 2 minutes of testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Pete Whedon, and I own a fishing business in Homer. Today, I am not only representing myself, but also the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. And just as a side note, the reason I'm in Anchorage is I'm attending the Great Alaskan Sportsman Show, where we've had a booth since 1995. And there's many people that would probably be here with me in this room, but they're busy doing business. So, and I think the Kodiak folks are out drilling for oil spill drill over there. So kind of sparse testimony, but I'll continue. AMCC is a family of seafood harvesters from all over Alaska and includes fishermen, subsistence harvesters, marine scientists, small business owners, and families. Our ways of life, livelihoods, and local economies depend on productive oceans. We believe that the coastal residents have a valuable and unique perspective on marine ecosystem and have the right to meaningful and influential participation in fishery management decisions. I am sure that you have heard the presentations and testimony on H.R. 6, and we would like to thank Senator Michicki for introducing S.R. 5 in the Senate. The Gulf of Alaska non-pollock trawl fishery is operating without a cap on Chinook salmon bycatch, and when the council placed a cap last year on the pollock fishery, the cap was set higher than the 10-year average. At 25,000 Chinook, this will prevent the high bycatch of 54,000 in 2010, but still does not represent a meaningful reduction. Advocating for a 5,000 fish cap on the non-pollock fleet is the best choice for to reduce the waste of Chinook salmon in this fishery. SR5 addresses what we believe to be the best alternatives given the motion before the council. Now that would put a cap on the non-pollock trawl fishery in the Gulf of Alaska. The resolution further advocates for the council to explore ways to reduce all bycatch in the other trawl fisheries in the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska. And finally, a fish story. Last weekend, a fisherman from Anchorage who fished in the Homer Winter King Tournament caught a Chinook salmon that to him was worth over $41,000. These fish are very valuable to us and should not be wasted. The fish we caught on our boat did not win any money, but split amongst friends, it fed 7 households in Homer a king salmon dinner. Please pass SR5. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Pete. We are getting more and more folks signed up here to testify, so I am going to be strict about the 2-minute testimony limitation. We're next going to go to Kodiak, and there are 3 folks there. I'm going to start with Julie Bonney, followed by Steve Branson, followed by Terry Haynes. That'll be the order. So, Julie, are you there?
I am.
Great. I'll let you go ahead and begin. 2 minutes, please.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Julie Bonney, and I represent the members of Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, which are both shoreside processors and trawl catcher vessels that support fishery economies in Alaska coastal communities. We are certainly sympathetic to the Chinook salmon directed users and their pain due to the recent poor Chinook salmon runs. However, the entire topic of salmon bycatch is extremely complicated, an issue that stakeholders in the Federal Fisheries and the North Pacific Management Council have spent a large amount of time and energy to figure out ways to reduce and mitigate the impacts of bycatch. It's important for the committee to understand that the Gulf trawl industry and the Bering Sea trawl industry are completely different, both in terms of the Chinook salmon that we catch and the fishery management tools available for the fleet to reduce Chinook salmon bycatch. First, in the Gulf, Chinook salmon bycatch taken in the trawl fisheries are not coastal western Alaska stocks. For the Gulf, 99% of the 2011 genetic samples were from the Gulf of Alaska in the Pacific Coast region, with the majority coming from 40% from British Columbia, 26% from the Pacific Northwest, and 14% out of Southeast. All three of these regions have a huge amount of hatchery production with anywhere from 200 to 250 million fry a year. So what we're finding is environmentally, both in the Pacific Northwest and Canada, survival for Chinooks is high. So what it means for the fishermen that I represent is they're seeing more and more Chinook on the fishing grounds because of these other stocks. The other part I think it's important for you to understand is in the Gulf, we operate under a race for fish, which is a perverse environment for bycatch reductions, where the guy that catches the most bycatch potentially catches the most target fish and makes the most money.
Julie?
Bering Sea, I'm out of time.
You are.
Okay, I will submit my written comments to you, and I'm sorry. It's, like I said, it's a very complicated issue, and the Gulf and the Bering Sea are not the same. Thank you.
Julie, could I construe from what you said that you oppose Senate Resolution 5?
I basically what I would say is that there's a lot of information in here that isn't correct. And so if you wanted, we could go through line by line and help you with getting a correction. I really like the House version where they compliment the trawl industry and the North Pacific for all the efforts they've made. And honestly, we will continue to make efforts. So those would be my two suggestions for your resolution.
All right, Julie, Senator Machiki, I want to make a comment.
Julie, thanks for your comments, and I'm aware of the facts that you brought up. We actually, the CS is identical to the House version for your information. That might make you a little more comfortable.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Steve Branson, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
I'm Steve Branson. I represent the Crewmen's Association. We have 1,200 or so intermittent members. We're the largest faction of the fishing force and the largest labor force in the state. I have to support Senate Resolution 5 and would like to address first the incorrect information that the North Pacific Fisheries Council has been getting. I've dragged plenty, and I'm in contact with a bunch of trawl crewmen, and I've heard anecdotal stories of deckloads of king salmon, and generally, one does not report bycatch all the way. If you were to ticket, if you had drivers ticket themselves for speeding, I'm sure there'd be a lot less speeding tickets. It's kind of the way things go. And with our new observer program, we've seen through this random choosing of boats to observe a reduction in the amount of trawl observation and an increase in the amount of small boat pot fishing and otherwise less damaging fisheries. With a large net, you can make large mistakes in a short amount of time. So I figured that any law you make regarding fisheries should be accompanied by increased observer coverage. We'd all like to, a lot of people here would like to see 100% observer coverage on the low dollar, high bycatch fisheries, which that would give the scientific and statistical committee better ammunition to go and inform our inform our council. As I said, laws and limits mean nothing without observer coverage.
Thanks, Steve, for your testimony. The 2 minutes are up. Did you want to make a concluding statement?
No, I think I got it all out there.
All right, great. Thank you. And if you would like to submit it in writing, we would take the written testimony and attach it to the resolution so it would go with it through the process. Terry Haynes is next. Are you there, Terry?
Yes, I am.
Great. I'll let you identify yourself and give your testimony.
All right, I'm Terry Haynes. I'm a local commercial fisherman here in Kodiak. I also serve on the Kodiak City Council, but I'm just testifying for myself today. I just think that as a fisherman who works the docks and sees a lot of other commercial fishermen, you should never trade one resource for another. And, you know, I think we're most concerned when you see high levels of bycatch in species that are experiencing decreasing abundance. I really think that it's really important to say, Mr. Branson said, to increase the observer coverage in fisheries where we are already observing some high levels of bycatch in these species of decreasing abundance. If we had 100% observer coverage on any of these fisheries who even might be catching Chinook salmon right now, we could get a much better baseline and understand what's going on much better. And I think we should get more of the genetic sampling that Julie referred to. It would give us a much better look at where these salmon are coming from and going. But I must, in the whole, support the resolution. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Terry. I appreciate your testimony. Let's see. Next, we're going to go to the off-net, and we have Becca Robbins-Giz-Claire. She's apparently in Washington State. Can you hear us, Becca?
I can. Thank you. My name is Becca Robbins-Giz-Claire, and I'm representing the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association today. We're a group of subsistence and commercial fishermen the length of the Yukon River in Alaska. And I'm here today to support SR5. We have some written comments that we've already submitted to you that I think are included in the materials. But just to hit on a few highlights, I'm going to focus on the Bering Sea Chinook salmon bycatch. And we've really faced severe declines on the Yukon River over the past 5 years. We've had federal fishery disasters declared for every year since 2008. We basically have no more directed commercial fishery for Chinook salmon, and for the past 5 years, we haven't even been able to provide the amounts necessary for subsistence, which is designated by the Alaska Board of Fisheries every year. And early indications suggest that in 2012, the subsistence harvest was roughly half of the historic average. And we're not just talking about numbers here. We're talking about food on people's tables. We're talking about culture, and this is really a dramatic impact. We don't know what's causing the decline, but we're faced with controlling what we're able to react to. There have been huge reductions in river on fisheries to try to enable fish to reach the spawning grounds, and it's really important that we reduce mortality from bycatch as well. In the Bering Sea, the most recent genetic studies we have indicate that over 70% of the Chinook salmon taken as bycatch are of Western Alaska stocks, virtually all of which are declining and struggling right now. And yet we still have a bycatch limit, which is set at 60,000 fish as an upper limit. And really my overall point today is that under the current conditions of salmon abundance, that level of bycatch would be absolutely devastating. And we really support SR5 and the ask for reducing that bycatch. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Becca. Next, we'll go to the Petersburg LIO. Dave Beebe, I believe, is the gentleman who's there. Dave, can you hear us?
Thank you. Yes. Hi. I'm Dave Beebe. I'm a commercial fisherman for IFQ halibut and Dungeness crab, and also dive for sea cucumbers. And I'm also a member of the advisory committee to the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission, and this is from this perspective, I've been able to get sort of a direct input of information from people such as Eric Volk and others who are following this. And I'm profoundly struck by the decline in the statewide Chinook populations. And I really strongly support the reductions of Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska trawl fisheries and definitely support SR5 and HR6 in this regards. I think that the state has, it's one of its primary obligations really is to subsistence cultures and their extreme dependence upon subsistence resources, and Chinook plays a major role in this. And given the fact that we are in a profound population decline, it is incumbent upon everyone to look particularly closely at the bycatch and waste that has been well documented in the trawl fisheries. And I really hope that these resolutions do pass and that the predicament that is occurring here statewide be directly addressed. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Hang on one second, Dave. Senator Fairclough has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted you to restate your affiliation.
I'm speaking for myself. I apologize for that.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You mentioned I thought you said North Pacific Fisheries. Do you serve on the council?
No, I'm on the committee, the advisory committee to the North Pacific, the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave, for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to the Nome LIO, and Tim Smith is there. After that, we're going to come back here into the room where two folks have signed up to testify. So, Tim, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly. 2 minutes of testimony, please.
I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm the president of the Nome Fishermen's Association, and we're a group of sport, commercial, and subsistence fishermen in the Norton Sound region. And I fully support this proposal, this resolution. I think it's something that the state of Alaska needs to do, and I'm really commend you for putting it forward. I attended the meetings where the North Pacific Fishery Management Council set the king salmon bycatch caps for both the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska, and I was really discouraged and disappointed in the involvement that the Alaska delegates to the North Pacific Fishing Management Council weren't more active in getting a more reasonable cap set. And I think what you're calling for, a reduction of from 60,000 to 30,000, is fully biologically supportable. Norton Sound has been kind of forgotten in all this. Now that the bigger fisheries, the more important fisheries have started to experience the same type of problems we've had for 30 years, we're just kind of forgotten. Our problems have been going on for longer than everybody else's. The Northern Norton Sound, here's an example. The Northern Norton Sound has three king salmon populations. In 2012, on all these runs are below 100 individuals. 2012, the Pilgrim River had 64 king salmon. Boston Creek hasn't been counted since 2005, but when it was last counted, there were 29 king salmon there. The Quinnipiac River, in 2012, 36 king salmon passed the tower. And Fish and Game says that it takes 200 pairs of king salmon to be a viable stock. Well, all these stocks are biologically extinct. They're as endangered as any king salmon, or any salmon population in the United States. And for some reason, that's all kind of being missed. The situation with salmon management is a real constitutional issue. There's no way that you can call what is happening in Norton Sound with king salmon sustained yield. And the Alaska Constitution requires management for sustained yield. We're at the point where these populations probably aren't even going to survive, let alone produce any kind of a yield.
Kim? Tim?
Yes.
Your 2 minutes is up. You're sharing some great information, and would you be able to email your testimony, the rest of it, to us?
I sure can.
I mean, we're all sitting here at your numbers going, wow. So great testimony. The 2 minutes is up. Did you want to make a closing statement?
Well, it's just my final statement is that I don't think it's possible to harvest pollock the way we're doing it without destroying our king salmon runs. And we need to find another way to do it. If that means we don't take the entire pollock tack every year, I'm fine with that. Those fish are long-lived fish. They'll be available for harvesting next year. But we have to preserve our king salmon stocks. The Constitution requires it.
Great. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go here in the room. Stephanie Madsen is the first person signed up to testify. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you, Senator, and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Stephanie Madsen. I'm the executive director of the At Sea Processors Association and a 40-year resident of Alaska. The At Sea Processors Association is one of four sectors in the pollock fishery in the Bering Sea. So my fleet is only allowed to fish in the Bering Sea. And we are the offshore component. So the four sectors in the Bering Sea are community development quota. They get 10% off the top. And then the rest of it is split catcher processor, which is the fleet that I represent. The mothership operation, which is catcher vessels delivering to motherships, get 10%. And then catcher vessels that deliver shoreside is called the inshore sector, and they get 50% of the quota. So that's how we are structured in the Bering Sea. Madam Chairman, this is a complex issue. I did provide a presentation in the House Fisheries Committee, but due to the time constraints in front of you, I think I'll just focus my 2 minutes on what the program is in the Bering Sea that we're operating. Yes, the Council did establish a high cap of 60,000. If we violate the level of 47,000 in any 7 years, we live with 47,000 for the rest of the life of that action. But the unique proposal that was part of that was not just a cap. And I think that a cap is a way to shut down a fishery, but it doesn't provide incentives for the fleet and the individual vessels to do their best in every instance, every day. So the incentive program that the North Pacific Management Council set up was that we will give you access to 60,000 in those very, 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 very unusual years. We expect you to live with a much lower cap. And, oh, by the way, we expect you to reduce your bycatch in every level of pollock abundance and salmon abundance. And every year we have to go back to the council and demonstrate how our incentives, as part of this approved plan by the National Marine Fisheries Service, were working. And so April 1st, our report is due. It'll be our second annual report. And next Sunday, I will be making a presentation to the council about how we believe our incentives have worked. I've run out of time, but just real briefly, our program in the Bering Sea for our catcher processors is a bycatch avoidance area. So we monitor where the pollock fishing takes place, how much Chinook are caught in that area, and then we identify those as bycatch avoidance areas. We share that information with the fleet, and if a vessel's performance falls below a certain level, they are excluded from that area for a week, and there's another test that's later in the season that if they fail that, they're out of that area for 2 weeks. That's huge to a platform that has to catch and process at sea with a constant flow. I'll stop there, Madam Chairman. It's complex, and I live it day to day, so I'd love to sit here for hours and explain it to you.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen. Senator Dyson had a question.
Ms. Stephanie, good to see you.
Good to see you.
You must have started working at this when you were 13. Practically speaking, aside from avoiding the areas where there's a lot of king salmon, what are the other practical ways to exclude kings bycatch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dyson. We do salmon excluders. You know, we have a panel in our net that we have adapted by monitoring the behavior of the Chinook salmon. They're very strong swimmers, so they are stronger swimmers than pollock. So pollock fall back in the cod end. The salmon stay up front. And they also, not dive, but they jump, kind of. They go up. when there's a lee. I'm sure everybody knows where to catch salmon in the rivers because of the lee. So we've tried to use those behavioral aspects of Chinook salmon.
You're telling me more than
too
I
much.
Want to know.
Okay.
First,
all right.
One method is the salmon excluders. The other one's staying away from the areas where a lot of kings are being caught. Anything else?
Increased communication between the fleet, the hot spots, and the penalty that if you run out of your vessel limit, you pay. You have to get it from somewhere else to continue to fishing because you do get shut down.
And does the feedback loop go to the managers?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I mean fishing game folks, so they know where the hot spots are, where kings are being caught disproportionately.
It certainly is available. I'm not sure if they're on the weekly email list that we get, but that's certainly available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Machicki?
I want to thank Ms. Madsen for coming in, and she met with me today, and we talked about a lot of things. I was hesitant to add the praises that we put in the resolution. I'm happy to have them in there now. Again, this is not a blame game. I think that your organization has done a good job. We are in emergency management zone now. And we've got thousands of Alaskans out of work or wondering what's going to fill their freezer. And this is a strong request that we work together better to further reduce bycatch. But I don't want this to be viewed as this body or this senator trying to shut down the trawl fisheries of Alaska. They're very important to get our seafood to market globally. And that's something I want to see continue. I want to work with you to make sure that you can continue fishing and that we get every king salmon we possibly can to the rivers where they will spawn and get us back to normalcy. So I want to thank you for coming in.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator. And you can rest assured that in my capacity dealing with the skippers and the vessels, that salmon is on their mind every day.
Thank you very much. Ricky Geese is the next person to testify. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, my name and fellow committee members. My name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association in Soldotna, Alaska. We're a 501c3 fishery conservation organization representing some of the over 100,000 anglers who like to fish for king salmon throughout south central Alaska and the rest of Alaska. Just a decade ago, the Kenai River king salmon fishery was rated as the number one sport fishery in North America. That's a pretty impressive statement for all the different sport fisheries all across the country, including Florida and the Gulf and San Diego and all the other places. Field and Stream said that the Kenai was the top dog of all those fisheries. But the Kenai, along with Norton Sound, Yukon, Kuskokwim, other areas in Cook Inlet, Kodiak, Copper River, have all seen dramatic declines in Chinook salmon. Just recently, Fish and Game, to deal with the problem in Cook Inlet, reduced the escapement goal by one-third for late-run Kenai River king salmon. We did not agree with that because we think that's just driving it further in the ditch over the long term. But many of our management plans that in-state that we have management for were developed in times of high abundance, and now we're going through the painful process through the Board of Fish process to deal and reintroduce these plans and reevaluate them in terms of the low abundance. And I think the same thing that the council has to take the same approach, and I think it's time for the council to look at the bycatch limits that we have both in the Bering Sea and the Gulf. And I am familiar with the differences between the Bering Sea and the Gulf. I do think that the Bering Sea has many more tools to reduce Chinook bycatch, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel for the Gulf of Alaska. They can use many of those tools if they get catch shares introduced into the Gulf. I know that's controversial in the Gulf fisheries, but I think time has come to bite the bullet because the king abundance in south central Alaska is declining rapidly, and you know 30% of the Gulf harvest does come from the south central area, and even thousands of fish can make a difference. I would say if you're going to add something to these resolutions, there's three points that I would put. One is on the observer program. Please encourage the council to authorize the observer program to get research data from the bycatch that is caught. We're trying to figure out where the bottleneck in production is for king salmon. And it'd be nice to be able to get age, size, and length data from that, maybe to get some fat content, stomach content, to figure out what they're feeding on, how robust they are at the 1- and 2- and 3-year-old stage out there. The second thing is, at least in the Gulf, start getting harvest data for the observer from the observer program. And it doesn't, I know there's complications, you have to put people on, people don't want that, but maybe just get video data that's time stamped where, and so you start developing the hotspot capability that the Bering Sea has. And third is bring in the incentives that the Bering Sea has to trade quotas if one vessel or another, so it's not a race to fish and you don't get rewarded for having a high king bycatch. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Geese?
I just have a comment, Madam Chair, and I will talk.
Senator Machicki.
I will talk to you about some of the specific data possibilities on a limited basis. Right now, we have a zero fiscal note, but we can talk about that and certainly see what might fit.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone else online or in the room who wishes to testify on the CS for Senate Resolution Number 5? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Are there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or any further comments from committee members? Seeing none, what is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair, I move that we move CS for Senate Concurrent Resolution 5, Version C, from Committee with Individual Recommendations, attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Seeing none, this Senate resolution will move from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the transmittal document. Senator. All right, we're back on the record. And next on the agenda, we have AGDC Vice President and CFO Joe Dubler here to speak to us about the financing and ownership models associated with mega projects. Along with him is Angela Rodell, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. So welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Joe Dubler, Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of the Alaska Gasoline Development Corporation.
I'm Angela Rodell, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue.
Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to present in front of your committee today. I believe you have the presentation in front of you. I wanted to start off with, we had discussed tariffs, going through tariffs as well. So if I could start off just a very brief primer on tariffs.
That'd be great.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you, Madam Chair. There are three basic factors that affect tariffs. Capital expenditures, operating expenditures, and throughput volume. The tariff calculation itself is quite complicated, but the concept is really pretty simple. All you're trying to figure out is how much the line's costing you to operate and build, and then how much is going through to be able to allocate those costs to the throughput. So the volume in of those three, the volume is the most self-explanatory. It's the amount of gas that is anticipated to be shipped through the line. So that's pretty easy to determine. And it's still, these are all projections typically when you're setting up a tariff. It's a forward-looking projection. The capital expenditure number is the allowable non-operating costs of construction and includes items like engineering, permitting, pipe purchase, and facilities purchase costs. So that's all the pre-operational costs that you incur in order to get the facilities and the pipeline up and running. The operating expenditures include operations and maintenance, depreciation of the capital expenditures that we just talked about, over the depreciable life, taxes, and interest expense. The tariff model, and the AGDC has a pretty robust tariff model, is simply a forward-looking pro forma income statement that calculates the projected net income of a project, in our case the ASAP project, such that it equals the net income equals the equity capital contribution times the return on equity. And it's kind of an iterative process where you go through and it calculates and runs through multiple iterations to come up with that number. And so what you end up with is a tariff that covers all your costs, your capital costs, all your operating costs, your debt service, and your return on equity to the equity investors in the pipeline. That's what a tariff model does. Like I said, it's a pretty simple concept. The actual application, it's a fairly complex spreadsheet. But it's really, when you get into it and look at it, it's really not that bad.
Great. Questions? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize in advance to Senator Machicki. This is remedial for him, I understand. But
he's awake. He's doing fine.
The presentation you have in front of you is called Financing Mega Projects, and it's something we just put together real quick to just give you an idea of how large projects are financed. They're typically done in a number of different manners that we'll get into. The first page on financing overview, the objective of financing any project is to achieve the lowest overall possible cost for that project. The way that, and I don't know if this is common, but the way I like to do it is look at it from the investor standpoint, since those are the people you're selling the bonds to, and you seem to be able to get a better price for something if you're selling something that the buyers want than something that you want to sell. And that's the way I've always approached it. So we try to structure a financing package to make it as attractive to investors as possible. And you do that through meetings with investors, meetings with the bankers that are selling the bonds, and they meet with investors and get an idea of who's out there, what they're looking for, and then you can structure the transaction around that. Typically, there are two sources of funding for a project, equity and debt. And I put them in that order because equity is typically the first dollars into a project and followed up by debt on the backside. Each of those two types of funding has advantages and disadvantages, and we'll talk about that later as well. Rates of return for both debt and equity are determined based upon several factors that basically reward investors for taking risk, and that's the old classic financial model, risk-reward. You increase your risk, you increase your reward. And the formula I label it, investment yield equals the inflation rate, which is a baseline that is basically compensating people for the time value of money, plus a risk factor, plus a liquidity factor, and that gives you what an investor is looking for in a yield on a security. The estimated inflation rate is based on a benchmark, which is a treasury bill, which is considered a risk-free and highly liquid security. And so the interest rate on a treasury bill is considered roughly equivalent to the estimated, or the inflation rate that the market is estimating. So when you go out and look at the treasury market, that'll give you an idea of what the market thinks the inflation rate is. There's some differences in that. For instance, the treasury had some liquidity issues earlier, 3 or 4 years ago, and there's some of that, but typically it's the inflation rate. The inflation component of an interest rate represents the time value of money. That's the concept that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. So it's due primarily to an inflationary economy in the United States over at least my lifetime, and I assume everybody's, unless anybody went through the Great Depression, and nobody looks old enough to have done that. So most of our... a great example of inflationary time was the 1970s, when interest rates were very high, mortgage rates were in the high teens and low 20s, and that was due to the very high inflation during that same time period. You know, it's probably some OPEC-related issues that caused that, but there was a lot of inflation, and therefore interest rates were very high. The second factor is a risk factor, and the risk component represents the risk that a borrower will default or not repay the debt as agreed with the issuer. A good example of this is in all of our lives, your personal credit score. And we've all seen the huge emphasis put on that in the last 3 or 4 years with the mortgage meltdown, that everybody knows what a 720 is and a 680 is, and you know that's your score. Well, the higher your score, the lower the mortgage rate you've got. Mortgage bankers have gone to a risk-based pricing model where the higher your credit score, the lower the rate you'll pay. And typically, the rate that they advertise in the paper is the lowest rate for the highest rating, and it goes up from there. So it's a teaser rate, basically. Another example is the Treasury yield issue. Recently, there was such a flight to quality. People were so worried about the bond market that they were investing so heavily in the Treasury market. Treasuries for a couple days actually experienced negative yields. People were paying money to own Treasury bills. And it was very, very, very small amounts, but it was still a theoretical impossibility, at least in the finance classes that I had in college. So the liquidity factor, that's a component representing the risk that an investor will not be able to readily exchange their investment for cash if they need it. Investments that are traded on normal exchanges are usually fairly liquid. Bonds are usually fairly liquid if they're in investment grade credits. Some stocks can be liquid, some stocks aren't liquid. You know, junk bonds, things like that aren't very liquid. Equity shares in projects such as what we'd be talking about here are not very liquid at all. They typically involve attorneys to purchase. You know, it's not something you just trade on online, basically. The recent meltdown in auction rate securities market, and this is kind of an obscure reference, I just know this because we were involved in it. We had some outstanding auction rate securities were ones that didn't have any definite liquidity. They relied upon a frequent auction, typically 28 days, some of them up to a year, to where every 28 days they'd hold an auction and investors would come in and bid on the bonds. That's great as long as you have people bidding on the bonds. What happened was cash got short, the liquidity got short, and people quit bidding on the bonds, and the market crashed. So, and the interest rate on those bonds went through the roof because investors knew that instead of a 28-day security, they now might have a 25-year security because that was the final maturity. But they were all, most of them were AAA-rated U.S. government-backed securities that were trading with very wide margins to the rest of the market because of liquidity. Mm-hmm. Equity financing is riskier than debt financing and costlier due to equity investors usually put the first dollars into a project. Bondholders don't want to take a lot of, at least long-term bondholders, construction financiers will, but long-term bondholders won't take completion risk. And that's the risk that a project doesn't get completed as proposed. The Whoops bonds in Washington is a good example. That was a project that I believe they finished completion and they never actually operated the facility. All those investors lost everything they had. I mean, I believe there were bonds on that too, though. They just never got anything out of the investment. That's a risk that bondholders typically will not take, and Whoops didn't help that situation any. Equity shares, unfortunately, are not very liquid. It's much more difficult to sell equity in a project than a bond issued for the same project, because a bond, you can trade on most markets. For those reasons, it is advantageous to a product's cost of funds to keep equity investing. The equity portion of the financing as small as possible, and the debt portion as large as possible, within reason. And there's a balancing act you got to go through. It's more of an art than a science, depending on the project. some of the equity financing options, they can go anywhere from 100 on this particular project from 100% state ownership to 100% private ownership. And keeping in mind that the 100% isn't of the total project, but of the equity portion. So if it's a 75-25, you'd be talking about 25% of the project would be state-owned versus 25% would be private-owned. One of the advantages to a state-owned pipeline is that the state would have more control over the components of the pipeline. They would be able to dictate, you know, the structure, what kind of gas, everything to do with the pipeline. Obviously, the owner gets to decide those things within reason. I mean, the market still has to buy the product, but some might say this is also a disadvantage to having the state owning the project, that the state's responsible for it. There have been instances in the past where state-run projects didn't turn out so well, and a lot of people have brought that up to us in the last couple of years. The main advantage to a privately owned...
Excuse me, Mr. Dubler. Yes, Senator Dyson, question?
Yeah. It's very instructive, and I appreciate it. On bullet two, when you said state-owned, state would have more control over components, what do you mean by components?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, components just was meant to represent all aspects of the project. You know, how much gas got shipped through it, and you know, we've been talking from the beginning that the customers are what's going to determine what goes through the pipeline. So, and that's where we get to the private sector in a minute. They're a little better at judging, I think, sometimes what the private sector is looking for, because that's what the business that they're in. But they would get to determine how big the pipe is, what the throughput would be if they had the customers for it, those types of things. So where offtakes were.
I may continue. Yes. So it's the physical configuration of the project itself. Does that mean also how the construction is done, project management?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, yes, they would control all aspects of the project.
But the final one that's most important is whether or not this is a common carrier, in essence. Who controls, who can get on the off-ramp with their project, and who can get on the on-ramp and on the off-ramp for the project?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think what you're referring to is the common versus contract carriage issue. If the state owned the pipeline, they you know, subject to the whatever state laws are in place at the time, they would be able to control the
I understand that, but inputs if and not, that's what we worry about, is indeed a de facto monopoly.
Yes.
And would you care to speak to that?
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Dyson. Any type of utility or transportation of gas, electric, anything like that, you typically have a monopoly. You won't run two electric lines to the same house, and that's why you'll have some type of regulation typically in a monopoly situation, and that's fairly common. In the national, like within interstate pipelines, it's FERC regulates interstate pipelines. Intrastate type pipelines are typically the state regulatory authority would have some sort of regulatory authority over those pipelines.
Follow-up, Senator?
If it's considered a utility, you know, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska doesn't control taps. And so you're thinking of this just in the category of supplying energy to Alaskans, not with export?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, no, this would just be a transmission line. This would just be transporting gas from the North Slope to Fairbanks and South Central. But as far as regulation, I think we're getting awfully close to the issues that are covered in the bill, and I've been instructed to avoid those at all costs.
We don't have the bill before us.
Until we have the bill.
Theoretic, if you will.
Yeah, but when you talked about the advantages of state and private owned, I didn't see the bullet that says the control of whether it's open or restricted access on that. That's why I brought it up. Mm-hmm. But let's forget it and go on.
Thank you, Senator. The main advantage to a privately owned pipeline is that the private sector is probably best equipped to own and operate pipelines. There's some very good companies out there, very large companies. That's what they do for a living, and they do it every day. And so there's some hesitation to get the state involved, and at least we've heard it over the past couple of years, because, you know, let the private sector do it. That's what they do. And again, the disadvantage is the state loses control over certain aspects of the operation and construction of the line that aren't regulated by current laws.
Yes, Senator Michicki, question.
Thank you. Just wanted to clarify, and this isn't project specific, but there would also be a federal jurisdictional component to any 192 line as well, even if FERC is not involved in the regulation.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, yes, there's a lot of regulation on this pipeline, and a lot of permits and a lot of regulations that we're complying with and will be complying with. So we're
thank you.
It's actually mind-numbing how many permits and stuff we've got to go through. It's a lot. And Madam Chair, for the debt financing portion, I'd like to turn this over to Deputy Commissioner Rodell, the State Treasurer and Deputy Commissioner.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Revenue. To speak to the debt financing portion of this, as Joe said, that there are a number of different vehicles that are available for the debt portion. We're going to focus today on three of the most common, which are general obligation bonds, project finance, or revenue bonds, as others have referred to them, and then the state moral obligation. So general obligation bonds would obviously benefit from the state's rating, which is AAA from all three rating agencies. It would enjoy an extremely low cost of funds and make a very straightforward credit analysis because the rating agencies would be looking straight to the state and the state coffers for repayment of the debt. However, the downside to general obligation is that they do require voter approval, and so they require some steps that may make it more challenging in order to issue the debt. Any general fund appropriations, in theory, if general bond or general obligation bonds were approved, any appropriations for debt service could potentially be offset by revenues and creating an agreement with an entity to return revenues back to the state general fund in order to cover that debt service. Moving on to project financing or revenue bonds, this typically has no direct impact on the state of Alaska. The project is looked at as a standalone basis. The revenues are assessed, so in the case of a gas line, the shipper contracts, what type of revenue those will generate, how much debt can those support to be repaid, a rating is assessed, the bonds are issued up to the amount that investors are willing to take in terms of risk and leverage and how much coverage, and the revenues are received and directly repaid to the bond investors. And then we come to state moral obligation bonds. And state moral obligation is really a credit enhancement to the revenue bond project finance construct. And you will not see in legislation, if you do a search in existing statutes, you will not see the words moral obligation anywhere in statutes. It's really a legal construct that the state has used, which requires, which creates a capital reserve fund made available to an entity, and then requires that if that reserve fund falls below a requirement or a certain amount, it obligates the issuer to come back to the legislature and request replenishment. So that obligation to request replenishment is, in fact, the moral obligation. There is no legal requirement or binding requirement on the legislature to fund that request like any other appropriation, but there is an expectation by the part of investors that you will step up and honor that request, and it shows evidence of support for the project. And as a result, investors are willing to pay more or take lower interest rates in return for providing that credit enhancement. And so there is definite financial benefit to issuers who are allotted the moral obligation, but it does come at a, it does affect the state's credit rating in that it's viewed as a real obligation of the state. And with that, I'm actually going to turn it back to Joe unless there are other more specific questions.
Senator Fairclough has one.
This is going, we don't have a bill in front of us, so this is down a rabbit trail. Mm-hmm. Kibata is going to be before the Finance Committee specifically, and I'm thinking I heard the word moral, a state moral obligation listed in that financing package. So you are saying on the record that that does affect the state's bonding rating?
Yes, it will.
Thank you.
And if I could just clarify for the record how it affects it, is that it doesn't affect the state's rating sitting here today. We keep track of how much moral obligation debt is outstanding. Where it comes into play is that once you make that appropriation and honor that obligation, all of the outstanding debt attached to that obligation moves over, and from the rating standpoint, becomes state debt. And so we at Department of Revenue keep an eye on how much moral obligation debt there is. Not that we're counting the full amount, but we're keeping an eye on it so that we have an assessment of the potential impact on the state's overall financing, and so that we can explain it to the rating agencies and they understand that we know exactly what's going on with all the state's assets, including its debt capacity.
Further questions? Senator Machicki.
Just a quick question on the project financing section. You said no impact on the state of Alaska. I think what I hear you saying is you're essentially using, you would use the state's credit rating to obtain the general bond financing, and then essentially you have a toll bridge with the cars paying the toll is cubic feet of natural gas that are paying, it's paying a tariff. Mm-hmm. Is that my understanding of essentially what you're saying, that it's not technically on the books, it's standalone credit, doesn't hit the general fund, and it's okay.
Right, and you can only, investors will only allow you to issue enough debt that they think the revenues will support. Mm-hmm. So you can't go out, you may have authorization to issue $500 million, $1 billion, but if all the revenue assessments, whether it's pipeline or tolls or whatever, says we think you'll only raise enough revenue to support $200 million of it, that's all the markets will allow you to sell.
Perfect. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, back to the presentation, project finance optimization, and what this is about is, again, trying to come up with the lowest overall cost of funds to finance a project. And the goal of the project financing optimization is to strike an appropriate balance between debt and equity, such that you get enough equity in, and kind of the quandary you've got with these projects is investors want there to be more debt in the project, and debt people want there to be more equity in the project, because each of those situations make the other feel more secure. So it's striking a balance between those so that you do get a cost of fund that'll work for you. And that's needed, obviously, again, because of the different yields. The yield on a typical yield on a pipeline project like we're talking about is somewhere in the and they've been coming down, but they've been in the 10 to 12, 13% range, whereas debt is somewhere in the, you know, 4.5, 5 to 7% range. So there's a very large difference in the cost. So you want to minimize the 12 and maximize the 5 or 6. The ownership models for a project, we've had a lot of debates about this on how, you know, if there's going to be partners, is there going to be partnership, how it would work. And I think that the conclusion we've come to after a lot of debate and discussions has been that it'll probably end up with each of the entities will have a pro rata share of ownership commensurate with the amount of gas that they're shipping in the line. Which, to use the state as an example, if the state has an eighth, which is their royalty percentage of the gas, then if that flows through to the state model, then the state would own an eighth of the equity, or would contribute an eighth of the equity to the pipeline. Whether the state wanted to do that or not is entirely up to the state. If not, you would have the builder, the owner-operator do it, or one of the other shippers would participate. This allows shippers a percentage of control in the line equal to the amount of gas they're committing to the project. Because when they commit their gas to the project, they're taking a risk. If the tariff you're projecting is $9, and the preliminary tariff, and it comes back and it's $12, that's a problem for shippers, obviously. And so they're taking a risk in committing their gas, and they want to have some control over that process. The target capital structure for, I believe, both the APP and Denali pipelines, that's the information I've gotten, was 75-25 debt to equity. So you'd have three quarters of the project would be financed through debt, and 25% through equity, and that seems to be a balance that works. So, with that, Madam Chair, I'd conclude my remarks with a thank you for allowing us to present today. And if you have any questions, we'd be more than happy to continue to address them.
Great, thank you. Questions, committee members. All right. Thank you. It was really informative. Of course, we don't have a bill before us, but we do expect very soon to have one. And so that was part of the intent, was to help prepare the committee for that bill. In closing, our next meeting will be Monday, April 1st. We'll take up consideration of the governor's appointees to the Big Game Commercial Services Board and the Board of Fish. A reminder, next week we are scheduling additional times for this committee because of the anticipated bill that we'll be receiving. So I know that your offices have been contacted about afternoon meetings on both Tuesday and Thursday, and also extended meetings into the evening on some of those days. I've also booked this room for next Saturday as well, in case it's needed. So, in any case, have a great weekend this weekend. And with that, the committee will be adjourned. The time is 4:44 p.m.